Good afternoon. It's 3 o'clock and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on Thursday, the 27th of October, the year 2011. Jeff Brown with you here on a Juneau afternoon. We will find out about the Fall Fun Fest at the Mindanao Glacier Visitor Center this Saturday with guests Jane Terry and Irene Morris. Kyle Pickett and Fortolino Lagandino will be here to talk about the Juneau Symphony's production this weekend of Sweeney Todd. We'll talk to Alexander Dolitsky about his new book, Living Wisdom of the Far North. And Nancy DeCherney will be here with news and views about local arts and cultural activities during Arts Up. It's today on a Juneau afternoon. Well, the forecast for tonight looks like rain is likely with low temperatures around 38 degrees. Forecast for Friday, rain likely, high temperatures around 44 degrees. It looks like rain is likely through next Wednesday.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. House passes legislation to swap copper-rich land in southeastern Arizona for a large swath of new public lands. As Matt Laszlo reports, the House also defeated amendments Wednesday to protect tribal lands in the region.
The bill gives British and Australian-owned Resolution Copper more than 2,400 acres of land replete with copper. In exchange, the government gets more than 5,000 acres of new public lands. Democrats offered an amendment to protect land sacred to Native Americans in the region, including Apaches and Zuni Pueblos. It was defeated. Arizona Democrat Raul Grijalva opposed the bill.
This legislation will take thousands of acres of healthy, protected, sacred public land and convert it into billions of dollars in corporate profits for two foreign mining companies.
Republicans argue the land swap will create thousands of jobs in Arizona and bring billions of dollars into the U.S. economy through taxes. And Arizona Republican Congressman Paul Gosar says tribal leaders already lost their claim that the site is sacred, protected land.
And we've exhausted all that. You know, they talk about relics and sacred sites. We've actually got, there's an exhaustive example of this, and they actually challenged it in court, and the courts upheld it. So we've gone through a court of law and doing our due diligence with this. Time's up. Time's ready to go.
Arizona Republicans are optimistic the bill will pass the Senate because they say Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid of Nevada favors the exchange. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Family and friends celebrate the life of late Pueblo historian Joe Sando. The Jemez Pueblo scholar, author, and lecturer had a rich knowledge of New Mexico's 19 Pueblos. Dozens of people gathered this week at the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center in Albuquerque for Joe Sando Day. Events included a writing wall, speakers, a video, and this reading by Walatoa Charter school students from Jemez Pueblo. Walatoa teacher Francis Vigil says Sando inspired him to become an educator. Vigil remembers a conversation they had.
He kind of quietly turned to me, and because I have a science background, and he was saying there's not a lot of Native educators, especially males, especially in science. He said, you would be somebody that would be able to help in that regard.
Sando was known for promoting indigenous people to take control of their own histories by writing, recording, and telling their own stories, saying many stories about Native people are written from a non-Native perspective. Vigil says that's being passed on to students in Jemez Pueblo along with language and culture.
They're understanding what the ramifications of being able to have control of that, the educational control, and to be able to have a control over your community and have that mastery of who you are and have that identity. And I think that's one thing that was really important. And I think that's that my dad and I were just even talking about how Joe was always there. Like, even though he didn't necessarily live in the Pueblo because he had so many different commitments all over the place, he always returned back for those ceremonial days, for things that were happening in the Kiva, the things that, all of those things were important to him.
Sando passed away in September of natural causes. He was 88 years old. People from across the country are kicking off the National Indian Education Association Annual Convention in Albuquerque, New Mexico today. The event brings together Native leaders, educators, and students to focus on Indian education. During this month in 1949, the effigy mounds in Iowa were designated as a national monument. The mounds built by Eastern Woodland tribes are in the shapes of mammals, birds, and reptiles. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Support for National Native News comes from the National Library of Medicine, featuring its new interactive exhibition, Native Voices, examining the concepts of health and medicine among contemporary American Indians, Alaska Natives, and Native Hawaiians. On the web at nlm.nih.gov/native voices. The National Institutes of Health and National Cancer Institute, dedicated to improving the health of the Native American community. Funding health promotion interventions mutually developed by tribes and researchers. Learn more on how your local community can participate at www.grants.nih.gov. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:05 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Saturday at the Mindanao Glacier Visitor Center is going to be a fall fun fest. In the studio with me to talk about it are Jane Terry and Irene Morris. Thank you so much for coming on the station today.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you for having us.
So this is a Halloween fall fun fest. What's going to be going on 11 o'clock on Saturday?
Well, this is going to be a free event for kids of all ages, and we're encouraging people to come in costume. We're calling it the Halloween Fall Fun Fest. It's going to be this Saturday from 11 to 1, and we're going to have all sorts of fun activities, including slimy scale fish prints, a salmon toss into the real mouth of a bear scat investigation, and importantly, Irene will be bringing her barn owl, a live barn owl, so kids will be able to learn all about what an owl is all about. And then along with that, we're going to be investigating what owls have for dinner. We're going to have our regular ice worm wiggle maze, a photo safari tree, and then bones, we're going to have skull identification, bowling for bones, and then we're going to be looking for stalactites and stalagmites in a peekaboo cave. And last but not least, we're going to have rock art, which is petroglyphs and pictographs. And so the theme is about having fun while learning about natural history.
Are all these activities going to be going on at the same time?
Yep, they're all going to be running concurrently because it's a two-hour activity, so we have to get it all in quickly.
Are costumes encouraged?
Encouraged, indeed, yes.
And tell me about the Explorer's Corner, if you could, please.
Well, that's open year-round, all winter long. When the visitors are not arriving on the cruise ships, we do have a corner where the gift shop normally is located. And this is the Forest Explorer's Corner, which has books and activities Thursday through Sunday from 10 to 4. Oh, and puppets, yes. Irene reminded me. We have hand puppets, so those are really fun. So they're coloring books and books about nature, all sorts of good things for kids to do of preschool ages up through primary school ages, I'd say.
And I've seen a lot of costumes. How many years has this been going on?
Well, I was trying to pin that down, and I think it's roughly 10 years. I know this is my fourth year, and there were three people that did it before I did, so I'd have to say about 10 years here, and it came down from up north. There was a visitor center up north that did it first, so we followed in their footsteps, and so I think we've been doing it about 10 years.
What kind of animals can people commonly see at the glacier these days?
Well, you can probably see a raven or two without much doubt. Eagles, we have a pair of eagles out there. Occasionally you can see bear, but we still have the coho salmon in Steep Creek, so you could see the salmon spawning, the coho. The sockeye were here earlier, but now we've got the coho. And you might be able to see a porcupine or a beaver. You can probably see a squirrel. So magpies, things like that.
Was it a busy summer for the visitor industry there?
Yeah, it was a very good summer. Lots of visitors coming in from the cruise ships and independent travelers. So, yep, it was a busy, busy summer.
About how many bears were there?
Bears?
Probably about 15, I think.
About 15, yeah. Not all at once, of course. They travel independently pretty much.
I mean, tell me about your friend, the owl.
Okay, Nugget is one of our I'm with the Juneau Raptor Center, And Nugget is one of our education birds. He actually isn't from Alaska. We don't have barn owls in Alaska. This one came from California. He was kind of had a birth defect on his foot. He has a club foot, and so he couldn't be released to the wild, and we acquired him because we didn't have any other owls as education birds. Barn owls are probably the most recognized owl in the world, found on every continent except Antarctica, but they're more closer towards the equator. Although as our climate change is going, you never know, and they might show up in Alaska. But it is a real commonly recognized owl. It has the heart-shaped face and a white bottom. They actually sometimes have been called ghost owls. They're called barn owls because they live in empty barns. And sometimes as they would fly through the barn, they don't do a hoo, hoo, hoo. They have a blood-curdling screech.
Please don't do that.
I will not do that. But so when they do come, when they have come out of in vacant buildings, I'm sure a lot of people thought it was a haunted building because of this white-faced owl screeching as it came down.
Halloween Fall Fun Fest is happening this Saturday from 11 o'clock until 1 p.m. at the Minden Local Leisure Visitor Center. Should be a lot of fun. For what ages is this primarily focused on?
I'd say it's for preschool, elementary school, kids of all ages. Even the adults, the parents have fun. They come in costume, too. And photographs are encouraged, too.
And what kind of costumes have you seen that stick out in your memory?
Spider-Man, they're pretty scary.
Vegetables.
Yeah,
veneers. So those were adults that did vegetables. I think one was a tomato and one was a pickle.
Yeah, it's really fun to see what kind of costumes people make. The homemade costumes are the really fun ones because they are very imaginative. We've got a mosquito. I remember a mosquito costume made with strainers for eyes that were, it was really scary, spooky.
It's all happening this Saturday at the Minden Glacier Visitor Center. It's starting at about 11 o'clock and going until 1. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Well, I'm sure Lori Craig would like me to remind people that she's still planning this winter's Fireside Chat series, which will begin in January on Friday evenings and continue through March. So stay tuned for that because that's always a wonderful thing for people to enjoy out at the Visitor Center in January through March.
And what's the phone number there people could contact the people at the Visitor Center by?
That's our regular phone number, 789-0097.
All right, June Terry and Irene Morris, thank you so much for coming down to the station today.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
Springtime too, it's autumn, my love best. Fire in the fireplace, pumpkin in the yard. Give me a chore. It's not too hard. It's fall.
It's fall, that's all.
That's all.
Music from John McCutcheon's CD, Autumn Songs, appropriately for a day like today. Time is 3:15 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guests are Kyle Pickett, the musical director of the Juneau Symphony, also Flor de Lina Lagandino, both of them involved in the production of Sweeney Todd performances this Saturday and also Sunday. Kyle and Flor de Lina, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So Sweeney Todd, tell me about it if you could, please.
Yeah, well, this is the opening concert for the Juneau Symphony season here, our 49th season. And we are, of course, this weekend, which is Halloween weekend, and when we found out what our dates were, I thought that would be a perfect opportunity to do a project that I've wanted to do for a lot of years, which is to do a full concert production of Stephen Sondheim's musical Sweeney Todd, The Demon Barber of Fleet Street. And it is just, it's a terrific show. We're doing a concert version in the sense that the orchestra, the full Juno Symphony, is up on the stage, but we are far at the back of the stage, and then Flor de Lina is stage directing the show, and we're really doing a full production of the show down on the front in front of the orchestra. So it is a concert version in that the orchestra is not in the pit, and we don't have a bunch of fancy sets, but it's really a full production of the show. Just with the orchestra up on the stage.
Is this a unique way of directing it with the orchestra in the back and the actors out in front?
I think so. I mean, it's been done before with different musicals. I know that there was a famous version of this done at San Francisco. Juno Symphony did Carmen.
We did Carmen this way, but although when we did Carmen, it was much more just kind of a concert where the actors stood and sang. Mm-hmm. You know, they did go on and off, but they kind of just came out and stood. And Flor de Lina is really, I mean, this is a fully directed production. I mean, the staging is happening. The whole storytelling, you know, we go from beginning to end, all of the dialogue, all of the storytelling is there.
Yeah.
If people aren't familiar with it, could you tell me about the plot, please?
Yeah, well, loosely, it's this. There's a barber who's been unjustly sent away by a corrupt judge, and he comes back. He makes his way back to London to find out that the judge that his wife is dead, and that the judge has taken his daughter as his ward, and so he vows revenge on the judge. So it's a revenge story, and along the way, he meets up with a psychotic baker woman.
Yeah.
Who the two of them begin killing people and baking them into meat pies and serving them to the other people in their community. And all the while, this revenge plot is unfolding. It's dark, as you can imagine, but it's wickedly funny, and that's one of the things I like so much about it. So it definitely has the dark, the very Halloween-y kind of gruesome aspect to it. But there's so much humor in it, and our performers are just especially good, especially funny.
Is there a lot of stage blood in it?
Actually, no stage blood in this production.
Real blood, then.
Real blood. Yeah. Real blood. Yeah, we're actually going to cut people.
We can only do it once.
Exactly.
No. That's really the main difference between this and a full production is we don't have the full sets and the accoutrements that go along with that, like the stage blood. But it is costume. They're in costumes that are, you know, certainly very suggestive of the whole thing, and so there is a certain amount of pantomiming that goes along with that, with as far as the stage blood goes.
This must have been, pun intended, some monster of a play to put on.
It is a monster of a play to put on.
It's big. I mean, we have like 30 people in the chorus.
Yeah.
10 leads.
10 leads, 55 orchestra members.
Yeah.
You know, lights, sound, direction, the whole shebang.
Yeah.
And it's a very big project.
Do you split up the job of directing equally, or do you, Kyle, you take care of the music, and Flor de Lina, you take care of the actors?
Florilino's been doing the production, you know, directing the production, directing the actors and things. I think fortunately, and not surprisingly, but fortunately, we really agree on the concept of what we're doing, on the way that the drama unfolds and what's behind it. You can have different takes. I mean, there was a movie made of Sweeney Todd a couple of years ago, Tim Burton made, with Johnny Depp in it, and I actually particularly dislike it because I thought they really emphasized the gruesome and de-emphasized the humor.
Mm-hmm.
And when the humor goes away, the show is awful. I mean, it's an awful story. But with the humor, it really, it's palatable, so to speak.
Yeah. And one of the best performances ever given, I think, in musical theater was probably Angela Lansbury in this show. When I saw it, she's remarkable. She's ridiculously funny in the part, and that always surprised me because I've heard Demon Barber of Fleet Street being gruesome and bloody and disgusting, but it's funny.
It's very funny.
It's very funny.
We have the cast is all local people, with the exception of the judge, and that's played by Bill Gary, who's a former local. So he had done many things for many years with Lyric Opera, and so the rest of the cast is all local, and our Mrs. Lovett is Marta Lavstuka, and she's just hilarious. I mean, she is so funny and so good. And then Philippe Damerval is our Sweeney Todd, and he's amazing. Mm-hmm. I mean, the two of them together have this marvelous chemistry, and they're both just wonderful singers, and it's really fun to see.
So you don't have stage blood, you have stage shaving cream?
We have stage mime cream.
Mime shaving cream. They do have straight razors, though.
They do have real razors.
Real razors.
Tell me about Stephen Sondheim, if you could, please.
Yeah, Stephen Sondheim, he's the most important living musical theater composer, I think. For me, Sweeney Todd is the second greatest musical ever written.
Behind
West Side Story.
Oh, I don't. Okay.
Okay.
But I mean, Leonard Bernstein was certainly, you know, Leonard Bernstein and Rodgers and Hammerstein. I mean, and Lerner and Lowe are probably the other three, the three great, you know, two teams and Bernstein, and then there's Stephen Sondheim and his shows are vastly more modern than Rodgers and Hammerstein or even Bernstein, really. Yeah. They're complicated.
Mm-hmm.
They're very
literate, I'd say.
Very literate.
Very literate.
Yeah, and he writes the words and the music.
Yeah.
And I think Sweeney Todd is the pivotal show in his output. I mean, he wrote it in 1979. It's hard to imagine that the show, you know, was written in 79, but it pivoted musical theater, mm-hmm. I think, and everything that comes after Sweeney Todd really is after Sweeney Todd.
Mm-hmm.
It's very operatic in some ways, in that most of the storytelling is done in song, but it's very much a musical. I mean, it's not an opera; it's very much a musical. It is musical theater,
mm-hmm.
And it's full of puns. You would like it, Jeff. It's full of puns.
I'm speechless.
Yeah, I think the only other show that I like actually more than Sweeney Todd is Sunday in the Park with George.
Oh,
I love that musical.
Yeah.
It talks about, I think, the artist and this, how an artist strives for something and who judges what happens to that art.
Yeah. He also wrote Into the Woods, which I think has been done here
mm-hmm.
locally. And
Assassins,
which is also one of
it's
my favorite shows.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic show. It's about all of the people who ever did or tried to kill a U.S. president. And it's dark. I mean, there's certainly a darkness. But again, the humor aspect is always there. And the music is really beautiful. And in fact, when you're listening to Sweeney Todd, I mean, you get shades. You get the influence of Gilbert and Sullivan with these wonderful patter songs.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's an English subject. But you also have, I mean, there are lyrical lines that are sound like Mahler. And that's part of the reason why it makes sense to do this with a full orchestra on the stage. And, you know, I do a lot of musical theater in addition to my two orchestras. That's actually kind of my other, I moonlight doing a lot of musical theater conducting, and I love it. I love musical theater. I grew up with it. That's, you know, it's one of my great loves. But when you're in a pit, I've never been in a pit that can hold more than about 20 people really comfortably. And so, you know, to have 60 players up on the stage, you can really get that that sweeping sound that you can't get when the orchestra's down in the pit.
So who is the play for? Is it for young people, old people, everybody?
Oh, it's for everybody. You know, we put a PG-13 warning on it, which really, to me, means that parents should just decide how their kids would handle it. My son Ned, my oldest son, is 5. He really is interested in it, but I probably wouldn't take him. But in a few years, I would take him. And it's very much a story, mm-hmm. I think, and particularly our performance, because you don't have all of the buckets of stage blood. I think probably, you know...
There's simulated killing on stage.
There's simulated killing on stage, but it's all done for... Yeah. I mean, there's comic effect with it. It's really for everybody. I've been particularly excited that, you know, there's been a kind of surge of interest in the 20-something crowd, and that's great for a symphony. I mean, that's a little bit unusual in the symphony world. Yeah, it's for everyone. It's a great Halloween thing.
Yeah. It's just a great story, you know, and I think as far as, like, kids are concerned, it's how much do you talk to your kid is really the big thing.
Yeah,
if you can have a discussion with them, I think you can go pretty young.
That's why I said PG-13. I would just say, you know, you have to know your own child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I know that the actors will be in costumes. Will the orchestra members be in costumes?
The orchestra members will not be in costume. The orchestra members will be in black. There are certain things that we can't escape from the pit, and so pit black is one of those. Mm-hmm. We will be
black is a Halloween color anyway.
Black is a Halloween color anyway, exactly.
Are you encouraging zombies to attend?
Zombies can attend, vampires, you know, you can wear your costume. We'd be happy to have you wear your costume.
Yeah, you're welcome.
You'd be doing a pre-concert talk at all?
Yeah, we are. In fact, both of us, Flordolino and I, will both do the talk together, and so we'll talk a little bit about Sondheim. Maybe we'll argue about Son in the Park with George and the Woods and all. But pardon me, that'll be an hour before each of the performances.
I've been talking to Flordolino Lagandino and Kyle Pickett of the Juno Symphony. Their production of Sweeney Todd is happening this Saturday. Pre-concert talk is at 7 o'clock then?
Pre-concert talk, 7 o'clock. Show is at 8 on Saturday night. And these are at JDHS. Both of the performances are at JDHS. And then Sunday, the show is at 3 o'clock with the pre-concert talk at 2.
All right. Anything you'd like to add, if we're going to ask?
Well, the thing that I would add is just this is a rare chance to see this show locally. I mean, I'm not saying that it's not something that couldn't be done on a smaller scale, mm-hmm. but to really see, you know, with the big orchestra and the big singers and, you know, in a big space, this is kind of a rare opportunity. And the live experience of this show is so great.
Yeah.
It's so fun. And tickets sales are going very well. You know, we won't sell out. I don't expect that you won't be able to get tickets at the door because JDHS is big, so people can get tickets at the door. But tickets are going, and so I just advise people to go online and or call and get your tickets so you can get your reserved seats.
Well, people are dying to get in, I understand.
Yes.
Thank you so much for coming down to the station today.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
Never thereafter were heard of again. He trod a path that few had trod. Did Sweeney Todd, the demon barber of Fleet Street. He kept a shop in London town of fancy kinds and good renown. And what if none of their souls were saved? They went to their maker impeccably shaved. By Sweeney Todd, the demon barber of Fleet Street. Towel of Helen of Mott. For me, this he deserves a nod. The Sweeney Todd.
robber of Fleet Street. Inconspicuous Sweeney was, quick and quiet and clean he was, back of his mind, under his words, Sweeney heard music that nobody heard. Sweeney brother than Sweeney planned, like a perfect machine he planned.
Sweeney was smooth, Sweeney was subtle, Sweeney would blink and rats would scuttle. Sweeney was smooth, Sweeney was subtle, Sweeney would blink and rats would scuttle.
Time is 3:31 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guest is Alexander Jalitsky here, who's put together a book called Tales and Legends from Chukotka and Alaska, Living Wisdom of the Far, Far North. Alexander, thank you very much for being in the station today.
Thank you, Jeff.
So this is eight traditional stories plus two newer ones. How did you get the idea to put this book together in the first place?
Well, I collected nearly 370 stories altogether from Siberia. The Siberian Yupik Eskimos, tales of Kamchatka, Kerikskorik, Etelmans. And I published them, several years ago, just like an academic edition without illustrations. And this time I decided to choose eight traditional stories, four Siberian Yupik Eskimo stories and four Chukchis, and illustrate them lavishly and publish them for a broader audience rather than for the specialist in folklore.
Geographically, where are we talking about?
Well, Siberian Yupik Eskimos, they live on the tip of the Chukchi Peninsula, a little bit south. There are only 2,000 of those. And also that St. Lawrence Island, Gamble and the Savunga, they are Siberian Yupik Eskimo.
Tell me about the Chukchi people.
The Chukchi, there is about 16,000 Chukchis altogether. I believe that 14,000 live in the Chukchi Peninsula and 2,000 in the Sahara Republic and maybe in Kamchatka, north of Kamchatka. So they are a population that inhabited the Chukchi Peninsula sometime in the second millennium A.D., and so they're a sort of Mongoloid the race, quite different than the Siberian Yupik Eskimos in their genealogy.
I was trying to define the stories too, friend. They're not Aesop's fables, but they're fables, I guess, timeless fables that talk about the origin of the moon and the sky and the stars.
Yeah, well, they're quite authentic. In fact, recently the article was published by one of the Chukchi writer, and he called them those stories a Chukchi Bible. So those stories, you know, they were collected by or recorded by the Soviet ethnographers in mostly in the post-war period, and some of them were recorded in the 1920s, and they would be as authentic as the first edition of Grimm's Fairy Tales that's been recorded in 1813, even more so. I would not call them a fables. They are not fairy tales. Fairy tales, fairy is a kind of European version of the tales. Those are basically stories, and these stories, if I believe the Chukchi and Siberian Yupik would not be discovered or invaded by Europeans in, say, 17th century, probably today those stories would become a foundation of their own Bible.
Mm-hmm. In the introduction, you talk about four different types of stories that exist primarily in which you collected.
Well, it's a classification. You know, I just gave kind of broadly the mythology, and myth is one category. Domestic stories is another category. Domestic stories like the owl and the raven coexisted together, so that would be something like that. And the animal stories, there is the large category of that. And the legends, they classify by the folklore is differently. That probably that doesn't make any difference for the Chukchi or Siberian Yupik. It basically tells their stories. But the classification depends who classify what. Some, you know, the specialists would have 8 categories in classification. Some would have 4. So I just brought to the readers just general categories of the stories, and I selected some, like a heroic story, like a Kanakai Bed Antlers.
Could you tell me what do the stories mean, or what do they teach us?
Well, generally, the stories like the Chukchi tales, and I believe that Alaskan Yupik and Nupik and all the stories, they really teach how to behave in a society. I don't think they were, at least for them at that time, were a form of entertainment. They were basically the form of to pass the proper behavior and a morale from one generation to another via the oral narratives or oral tradition. But of course, today we are categorize these stories as a literature, oral tradition, oral literature, and obviously they teach different things. You know, the stories about heroism, the woman heroine who created the village, you know, or story, for example, I chose on the formation of the strait. It actually, it has some historic roots in it. It's a formation of the Strait of Inatlin, Imeglin Islands, and that's a little and big Diomede Islands. The problem was earthquake, and that was a tsunami who created the terrible damage that people remember, and that created the strait. So the story called Formation of the Strait, and I thought it's interesting just to choose the oral story that could have a connection, geologic and historic connection to, you know, some really things what happened in the past.
Tell me about the translation process.
Well, the stories were recorded in 1920s, 1940s, as I said, and of course they were recorded first in the native language. The language, the written language, appeared in for Siberian Yupik in 1930s. During the Soviet time, because before it was unwritten language or unwritten narration. And the same thing for the Chukchi. So they use the Russian alphabet, but it is, you know, Chukchi or Siberian Yupik Eskimos. And then they were translated into Russian, I believe, in the 1960s, 1970s by a specialist. You know, there is a very few left, by the way. And a specialist like a Dolgikh, you know, a well-known ethnographer, Menovshikov, Gurvich. They all already passed away. And Henry Michael, my colleague from University of Pennsylvania and my teacher and my friend, he translated most of the stories. He is a very well-known translator, one of the first translator of Soviet sources in anthropology since 1950s. And I worked with him for a long time. So he translated, I edited, I retranslated a few. So basically, we didn't customize those stories. They're very authentic the way they're told. But in this version, sometimes you want to make it more literary stories. Well, keep in mind that what we read today, the Brother Grimm's, for example, is 8th edition. The first edition was very, very much as what we translated from Russian source into English, or what was the original. And the Brother Grimm's, they customized them 8 times, you know, to make it appealing to the audience. So I didn't do that, but I did a little bit of twinkling with Liz Dodd, who is my copy editor, to make it more appealing, so it has a little bit of a literary aspect to it.
Now, there are 8 traditional stories that you got from the Chukchi people, and then you also took some of the best elements of the other stories and created your own 2 stories.
Well, I edited nearly 380 stories altogether, you know, 96 Kamchatka, 67 Chukchi, 56 Siberian Yupik, and now I'm working on Ganasans. It's a group of people in Tamir Peninsula. So by editing so many stories, I might as well can write my own. So I just thought to create 2 stories in the spirit of these traditional stories that I sent the photographs to illustrators from Southeast Alaska on the Awa Glacier and Menlo Hall, and they created illustrations, you know, kind of relevant to the stories what I send them. And Liz Dodd, my copy editor, she liked it, so I guess it sort of emulates in the style of traditional stories. And it basically tells us that we can write our own stories in that style. So it doesn't have to be always original stories. You can create the stories on your own, you know, using sort of a traditional, authentic style of retelling stories in the past by the native people.
Talking to Alexander Dolitsky, who's put together a book called Living Wisdom of the Far North. It's a beautiful book. It's a hardcover book. It's got nice thick paper. It's a quality publication. You've also got a variety of art.
Yeah, they're two wonderful artists, and I was very fortunate. I worked with them for 5 months, send them photographs, the scanning, the design of appropriate. So the Chukchi are not Siberian Yupikeski, most of them have to be different. And one is Lee Ross from Australia, one of the best wild artists in the world, by the way. So he did a job, for English version, and the Russian version was illustrated by Tamara Semyonova from St. Petersburg, and she used to work for Institute of Arctic and Antarctic, so she knows the subject. Also, I work with her. And now that the illustrations are displayed at Centennial Hall for the public, if they're interested.
And the book has four different audiences, I believe.
Well, traditionally we think that the stories, tales are for children. They are not. The Christopher Andersen and the Brother Grimm's today, we cannot read without this story without annotations and footnotes. They are not really children's stories. It's a folklore. And the same stories, of Klinky Tatapaskan, any native group in Alaska. The stories, the way I put it together with annotations and footnotes and glossary at the end and introduction in the beginning and forward, that could be appropriate for adults, those who are interested in the folklore, this type of literature. It could be for the students of Russian or English because they can compare both texts and to learn languages that way. And obviously for children. I tested this book in the different schools, in the middle school, in the DZ and high school. Students, they read it for me, so I'll kind of look at how they understand the subject. And I think its stories could be, I would say, from 12 years old to 18 would be very appropriate if somebody wants to use this book or this literature for a language arts course.
And where can people get a copy of the book?
Well, I got only 8 copies, so the shipment is coming. I think it will be here sometime early November, and it will be in obvious places. I would say I already have the orders from Rainy Retreat Bookstore, from June Arts and Humanity Council. The university bookstore buys my books, and they ordered Hardside, definitely will. What else I missed? The museum gift shop, they buy my books. And in summertime, probably some galleries.
If you'd like to see a copy of some of the drawings, they are on display at Centennial Hall right now.
The illustrations are on display, and they are beautiful. In fact, today I displayed 6 original copies of Tamara Semyonova. She sent me illustration 50 by 70 centimeters. It's how many inches is that? I don't know, but 22 by 28 inches, so it's quite big, and she illustrated in oil and acrylic, so it's actually paintings. It was very challenging to scan those with Alaska Lita. We had to do it in 4 sections, then patch them together.
Alexander Dulitsky, author of Living at Wisdom of the Far North, available soon at a bookstore near you. Thank you for coming by, and people can see the book perhaps at the Festival of Russian Culture.
Yeah, the Festival of Russian Culture will be on Saturday at 4 o'clock, and the books will be on display, and the Hardside will have their own section over there. So I welcome everyone to attend a wonderful concert and art exhibition.
Thank you for coming by the station.
My pleasure.
The Writer's Almanac for Thursday. It's the 27th of October, 2011. It's the birthday of Joseph Medicine Crow Highbird, born 1913 into the Absaluga people near Lodge Grass on the Crow Reservation in southern Montana, the oldest living man of the Crow tribe. Also the first member of his tribe to go to college. He was in the middle of graduate studies in anthropology when World War II began, and he joined the Army as an infantry scout. Returned to Montana, started writing academic works, collections of Crow stories, and his memoirs. His step-grandfather had been a scout for George Armstrong Custer and an eyewitness to Custer's last stand on the Little Bighorn. And Joseph Medicine Crow wrote about it in his book, Keep the Last Bullet for Yourself, The True Story of Custer's Last Stand. It's the birthday of Zadie Smith, born Sadie Smith in London, 1975, Jamaican mother, English father, wanted to be a tap dancer, then be a jazz singer. She managed to get into Cambridge, where she worked hard writing fiction. Wrote short stories, and one short story got too long to be a short story, and she kept writing, and eventually it became her first novel, White Teeth, came out in 2001. It's the birthday of the poet Sylvia Plath, born Boston, 1932, went to Smith while she was there. She struggled with bipolar, attempted suicide but survived, won a Fulbright scholarship to England, where she met the poet Ted Hughes, and they got married. Published her first book of poems, Colossus, in 1960, had a couple of kids. During a harsh winter of severe depression, she wrote most of the poems that became her book, Ariel. And it's the birthday of Dylan Thomas, born 1914 in Swansea, Wales, poet who traveled through America reading his work and who helped to popularize poetry readings. People flocked to see him. They loved his Welsh accent. He was extremely theatrical, and he was often drunk, so you had no idea what might happen at one of his readings. Here's a poem for today by Melina Merling, entitled After Rizzos. You know that moment in the summer dusk when the sunbathers have all gone home to mixed drinks, and you are alone on the beach, when the waves begin to nibble on the abandoned sand castles, and further out over the erupted face of the water stained almost pink, there are a few clouds that hold entire rooms inside of them, rooms where no one lives, in the hair of the light that soon will go gray and then black. It is the moment when even the man who mops the floor in the execution room of the prison stops to look up into the silence that grows like smoke or the dusk itself, and your mind becomes almost visible, and you know there is nothing that is not mysterious, and that no moment is less important than this moment, and that imprisonment is not possible. After Rizzos, a poem by Melina Merling from her collection Ocean Avenue, published by New Issues Press, Western Michigan University, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine. You can read the current issue of Poetry or listen to the monthly editor's podcast at poetryfoundation.org. And by CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight, nearly 500 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce fuel consumption. CSX, How Tomorrow Moves. Produced by Kathy Roach and Nick Vetter. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Arts Up on K2 is supported in part by the Juno Artist Gallery, a cooperative featuring the work of over 25 local artists and artisans. The Juno Artist Gallery is open year-round, located downtown in the Senate Building.
Time is 3:48, and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau, and we've got a whole bunch of activities going on. Nancy DeJourney, thank you for coming by again.
Okay, everybody needs to put their sprinting shoes on, because we're going to run through this pretty fast. Tonight at the Jack, at 7 p.m., it's Birth. I guess maybe it's Rebirth. This is their second performance of it, and it's being performed again because people wanted to see it. So 7 o'clock tonight at the Jack, it's $10 at the door. This weekend we have a Midsummer's Night Dream Theater in the Rough. The Sunday performance is a matinee at 2. Otherwise, it's at 7:30 Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Do not hesitate to get your tickets. It is a tiny little venue, and I know they're already sold out for a couple of the shows, at least from the tickets that we have. We got Tom and Dan. Tom Loker at the Zephyr, and Dan playing Hobson playing classical guitar at the Baranoff. We have Sweet Plantain on Friday. Now, I just want to say these people are fabulous. I had the opportunity to hear them perform today at Glacier Valley School, where I'm. They're wonderful. It is not it's not your ordinary string quartet. This is more. They play contemporary music. They play very. They're very engaging. I got a report in from Tom up in Haines, glowing reports. People in Haines loved them. They are performing at Friday at 7:30 at the Jack. So we have a deal going because there's so much going on this weekend. If you want to buy Sweet Plantain tickets and you already have Sweeney Todd, or if you get the two of them together, we'll give you a discount. Call over to the Jack and get that figured out. There's a Halloween bash Friday night at Latino's. It is, as you were just speaking with Alexander Dulitsky, the fourth annual Festival of Russian Culture at the Centennial Hall on Saturday. And on Saturday and Sunday, it is the performance of Sweeney Todd. This is going to be such a fun symphony concert with blood and gore and everything. I'm really looking forward to it.
No blood.
No blood. Okay. Pie?
And no shaving cream either.
Okay, then. But it's going. I recommend coming for the pre-concert talks at 7 o'clock or at 2 o'clock on Sunday. Kyle has lots to say, and it really helps with understanding the music and just is a really nice introduction. Plus, you can make sure you have good parking. Kari and the Wrist Rockets are over at the Douglas Inn, which used to be known as Louie's in Douglas, at 9 o'clock on Friday night. And the Great Alaska Bluegrass Band with Joe Page will be at the Alaskan Bar at 9:30 on Saturday. We have the usual international folk dance and ballroom dancing over at the Racquetball Club on Sundays. Some nice lectures going on, literary events. The evening at Egan on Friday is Widespread Changes to Alaska's Glaciers. That is at the Egan Lecture Hall on the UAS campus, 7 o'clock on Friday, and it's free. UAS is doing a class on free speech. This session is on insults, opinions, gossip, and defamation. You need to be 21 to attend. It's happening at the UAS Rec Center. You can go on our online and get the phone number for how you register for that. It's Native History Month, and they will be celebrating languages with Professor Lance Twitchell at the UAS Egan Library on Tuesday at 7 o'clock. The Wildlife Wednesday is with Michael Penn. That's at the UAS Glacier View Room on Wednesday at 7. We've got a couple of films going. Tucker and Dale vs. Evil is what's playing over at the Goldtown Nickelodeon. They're also doing Rocky Horror Picture Show at 9:30 at night, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. The Library is doing The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, and they're going to have live music with Bridget Cross and George Kuhar. This is the Downtown Library. It's free, 7 o'clock on Saturday, and they encourage you to come in costume. And the Gold Town's doing their kids' matinee, Sleepy Hollow, and it's a great pumpkin, Charlie Brown. That's at 2 o'clock on Sunday. Also, there's a fun thing happening, a drive-in Halloween movie in the parking lot between Valley Lumber and Juno Urgent Care, and you can call them to get your tickets. Even though it's free, I think you better get, there's limited space or something. They're showing Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. So lots of fun stuff to do.
That's one of my favorite movies.
Is it? Well, then you better get signed up. Also on Tuesday, Occupy Juno is showing The Inside Job at the Goldtown Nickelodeon. And I forgot to write down what time. I think it's 6:30. Also, there is a snowboarding film at Centennial Hall at 8 o'clock on Wednesday. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. It's like 12 to 12 or something. I should know, probably, but I don't. You can get tickets for this at Sequence or Aurora Project, and it's $10, 586-3529 to get more information, 8 o'clock on Wednesday. The Juno Arts and Humanities Council Teaching Artist Training Series begins tonight with Session 1 at 5 o'clock. If you're interested in participating, do call us. There'll be 6 sessions, and the first one is tonight. You always get pie at these. The second one is from 9 to 2 on Saturday. There's a digital storytelling class happening up at the City Museum. It's a series of 3 workshops with Alicia Jones. It's $60 to take the workshop, and they do still have some room in that series of workshops. 586-3572 starts on Wednesday at 6:30. There's a whole bunch of Halloween things going on, and you can get everything at the Empire in the Empire this week or today's paper, or go onto our website. There's pumpkin carving. There's family night at the turf. It's a dance. There's Halloween carnivals at the malls. There's just a whole bunch of things you can do. On Saturday, it's Going Meow Way, the Pet Fest. They did that last year. It's hilarious. It's lots of fun. There will be little dogs in Halloween costumes and all sorts of stuff. It's free. It's from 11 to 4 Saturday at the Jack. There's a Halloween Fall Fun at Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center for all kids. It'll let from 11 to 1 on Saturday. A spooky swim at Augustus Brown Pool on Saturday at 4:30. The Douglas Ghost Walk over at Mount Jumbo Gym from 4:30 to 6:30. The Night of the Living Derby sold out, but I'm told that if you come about 6:15, they may be able to have tickets at the door. So that's at Centennial Hall, Saturday night. Get there at 6:15 or no earlier than that, they ask, if you don't have tickets. Now, we have a real special event that's happening on Monday, and that's Halloween, which is special in and of itself, but we're having a salute to...
Hey, we ran out of time, Nancy.
Jeff Brown, Modest Mouse, is going to be, he got a Governor's Award for the Arts for Lifetime Achievement. He's going to be at the Juno Arts and Humanities Council from 5 to 7 on Monday. He's bringing a bunch of his pieces of artwork, postcards, colors, all sorts of different things, which you can purchase, and the funds will go to towards the scholarship fund. But most of all, please come down on Monday from 5 to 7 and just congratulate Jeff, tell him thanks for all the balloons in your life, and have a nice time. As I said, there are a ton of other things going on. I didn't have time. Well, for example, there's the open studios for the artists. Mary Ellen Frank, James Volkers, and Michelle Morell have their studios open this week, noon to 5 for Mary Ellen and noon to 4 for the others, two on, I think it's on Saturday. So go to our website. You can get the whole list of everything that's going on. It's www.jahc.org. And remember to get your costumes ready.
And you could also subscribe to the Juno Empire, and you could have this delivered right to your front porch.
Exactly. And, you know, like I said, the list today of all the Halloween events is all nicely laid out in the paper in the Arts and Culture Center. So be sure to pick that up. I hope to see you at all of the events, in fact. Sweet Plantain, Sweeney Todd, Midnight... Midsummer's Eve, whatever it is. And then the Jeff Brown thing. It's a busy weekend. I'm getting lost. Okay, that's all I have to say.
Thank you for coming by, Nancy, to tune in.
Thanks for having me.
Time is 3:58, and you are tuned to KTOO in Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Ock Bay area, tuned to K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Switzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT serves Huna at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTOO on K210 AS 89.9. And in Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau on Digital Channel 871, or also online at www.ktoo.org. Behind us, the music of Sweet Plantain. Tomorrow at 3 on a Juno afternoon, Pat Moore will be your host. We'll get the details on tomorrow night's evening at Egan presentation, Widespread Changes to Alaska's Glaciers, with guest Shad O'Neill. We'll also get a preview of tomorrow night's concert by Sweet Plantain. George Kuhar and Bridget Cross will highlight tomorrow night's movie presentation at the Downtown Library. And we'll find out about the Girl Scouts Halloween Haunted House at the Mendenhall Mall. It's coming up tomorrow at 3 on a Juno afternoon. With the forecast for tonight, rain diminishing in the evening with low temperatures around 38 degrees. Forecast for Friday, rain likely with high temperatures around 44 degrees. Coming up tonight on the Alaska Identity Project at 7 o'clock, host Adrian Lopez will bring back Deb Spencer. She'll talk about the South Seafood, Crosstown Seafood Scow Girls, an all-female floating fish operation. She'll also talk to Ketchikan artist Ray Troll. It's happening at 7 o'clock here on listener-supported KTOO News in Juneau. Coming up next, all things considered, thank you for tuning in to Juneau Afternoon today, and have a great evening.